Welcome to today's edition of Front Porch Talks. I'm Grayson Willis. Today's edition of Front Porch Talks is part one of a two-part live teaching session called Teaching Church that took place here at Harrisonburg First Church of the Nazarene on Thursday morning, March 30th, for a group of pastors and leaders from Virginia District. And in part one of the Teaching Church, my dad, Pastor Kerry Willis, had Michael Thompson, who is the Church of the Nazarene legal counsel, come and share with the pastors.
Our district superintendent is on his way. He's going to be probably just a few minutes late, so I'll allow him to greet us right after our break today. So we're going to go ahead and begin. You may have seen coming in today, there's some boxes of curriculum. This is curriculum that we used for years, and now we've shifted and are using other curriculums. But basically, this is a new believer's guide. They're completed, and when Jamie Baker was here, our executive pastor, years ago, he and I put these together. Basically, if you remember the series that John Maxwell had for new believers, we basically took his material, rewound it, and put it through our barrel, so to speak. But if you'd like to take some of these with you today for the training of new believers, it'll work for where you are. There's a leader's guide, and there are pupil guides on this. So we've got several boxes of it out here that we've had in storage, and I'm sorry I forgot it was there. But if you'd like to take a handful of this today, please do avail to it. With someone like this I got in my hand right here, Gary, go ahead. You're writing all the time. You might need some, brother. But if you don't want to give it to the man behind you, Dick's just going to start a ministry. My LPN. This was another curriculum that we wrote that is like part two of this, called Growing Down, Putting Roots Down. And so it's a little bit more of a discipleship, you know, discipling rather than new Christian, which is discipleship too. And there's also a two guides for this, and we called it a prayer laboratory for developing disciples. So this is also out here, and if you would like to have one is the instructor's edition, and the sepia tone is the student. So in the break or whatever, take some of that with you, and whatever we don't get rid of, we'll probably stick it back in the storage, because it is good material, and we paid good money for it, but we'd like for you to have it for free if you would take it. So here, take that mic. You might want that, brother. Oh, good, good, good. Okay, well, we're grateful that you're here today. Yes, Pastor Sam?
Along with the giveaways, we got some Bibles on CD.
Bibles on CD, okay. Are those out here as well? We'll get them out. Pastor Sam has some audio Bibles on a CD. And we just had gobs of these given to us. And if you don't have those, they make nice gifts, like for first-time visitors and things like that. You might put them in the CD player, make sure they play first, that kind of thing. But yes, please avail to those things and take them along with you. We're grateful. And what I want to do is, the next time we meet as a teaching church, I'm not totally sure when it will be. It could be September the 20th, whatever the Thursday is, 24th, I think. I keep wanting to say the 21st, but I believe it's the 24th. Somebody have a calendar that goes that far on your iPhone. September the 24th. Is that right, Bruce?
No, it would be the 28th.
21st. Okay, it is the 21st. And you don't trust your brain. You're getting old. September 21st may be the next time we meet as a teaching church. But if you can make a little note there in your calendar, I think it would be a good day if you have some experience books that you don't use. That we just have a book exchange, you know. Just bring some books. We'll put them on a table. You can leave some and take some. We have done that in the teaching church years ago, and it was very appreciated. So if you have some books that you've already read them and preached every page of them, and you want to get some fresh stuff, maybe we could do an exchange. And Bruce will remind me. He'll send me an email the week before.
I will.
And say, Pastor Kerry, remind the people in the email to the district to bring their experience books. But I think that's a good way just to help one another with the resources. Okay, well, we are grateful that you're here. There's some coffee out here and some bagels, a little bit of fruit, I believe. I appreciate Angela putting that all together for us. And Karen and Kim, who work here, have been rolling these resources out for us. So just appreciate their work early this morning. I've already had a successful day. I already got in and out of the DMV today, which is a miracle. Somewhere in JFK Airport, I must have lost my driver's license. That's the last place I saw it. So some cabbie's probably driving around in New York getting tickets in my name. Hopefully not. But anyway, I went to the DMV this morning, hoping to leave with my new license, but they mail it to you. Didn't know that. Well, just stalling a little because I saw a few folks still moving around. Mostly our people, you know, they're kind of rolling in now. Appreciate those of you who got up early. This morning when the DS texted me, I was just leaving our men's prayer group, and he was already saying he might be 30 minutes late, and I was reminded how early y'all have to leave, some of you, to get here. So God bless you, and I believe that you'll be glad you came today. Well, today is a day that I've had in mind for quite a while. Actually, we were planning this in October, but we postponed it because of scheduling with our speaker. But I got to meet Michael Thompson. Well, first off, I met him at a Coke church gathering when Louis Bussell was still with the World Mission. And he met with us in Orlando, Florida, and brought some of his folk with him. And we talked about partnerships in our churches, you know, developing partnerships overseas and these kinds of things. And it was a real effective meeting. And I remember he brought a couple of his close associates with him, and one was Michael. Michael Thompson, I think since 2001, he's been working at the Global Ministry Center, and he was really chief of staff for Louis Bussell. You can imagine what kind of job that was, trying to keep Louis focused. But Michael did that, and they were a great team, and Louis is like a spiritual father, really, to Michael. But I really remember Michael when I went to World Mission in Kansas City to do chapel a couple days there. And I met Michael, and we had a meal or two together. And just immediately, you know, just one of those people you just want to talk to, you just want to be around. And you don't get to see, looking at him, all that he's capable of. He's kind of like the duck with the feet underwater paddling. They look really, really smooth on the surface, but there's a lot going on underneath the water. That is Michael Thompson. But where I really got to know Michael was a year and a half ago, thereabouts. You remember me, if you've been a part of this at all, I went out to, what's the name of that town? Carthage, and what's the district?
Joplin,
Missouri district. I can never remember Joplin for some reason, mainly because it was almost wiped off the earth by a tornado, maybe a few years back, you remember. But I went to Joplin, where Mark Bain is the DS, and he called about four of us in for a week-long teaching with his pastors and leaders. And I just made great friendships there at that meeting. So Paul Borden was there, you know, for a week. He's already been on our district, shook us up really good. And also Mark Bain, who came and was at our district retreat. I talked with Dr. Fuller and told him, I said, you know, this Mark's a firecracker. I think we ought to bring him in. He did a great job, I thought, at the retreat. And then I met Michael Thompson. He was there to speak as the general counsel, legal counsel for the Global Ministry Center. And we had to listen to each other speak for like 5 days, you know, whether we wanted to or not, we had to sit there. And it was awesome. And as Mike spoke, I thought, first of all, Michael could speak to any group of people, but I think he especially could speak to our people. And so I told him that day I'd like to have him come sometime, and so today we're realizing that. He met yesterday with our staff and four other pastors who were able in the area to come and join us. He may repeat a few of those things, but he has things to talk to us about that we didn't know we should be talking about. And he's going to enlighten us on some things, and they're important. And in this world that we live in today, we've made a lot of jokes about the church manual, and we'll probably make some today. But in the world we live in today, I've never been more glad to be a part of a denomination who has already stated some things for us. And so we don't have to get in these long local arguments about certain things because we're under authority. And this manual is our authority. Not over the Bible, I understand that. But the idea of it's really, we're better together. I'm glad I'm not an independent pastor in some church trying to figure out all the laws and all the craziness that seems to be going on in our world. And so Michael is the one there at the Global Ministry Center who feels all the questions and all the stuff nobody else wants to deal with. And that's who he is. And the fascinating thing about it, he probably is a little sick because he enjoys it. He enjoys his job. I don't think it means he's sick. I think it means that he's found his calling. I've asked Michael to come first today, and if he's still in that order, that's fine. If he shifts, that's fine. I want you to hear his testimony, because not only was he a prosecutor before he went to Global Ministry Center, attorney, but he also is an ordained elder in the Church of the Nazarene. And God has gifted him, I believe, for such a time as this. And I'm glad he's younger than me. That should mean that my tenure as a pastor will be over before he's done. So I know I got help all along the way. So it's like my doctor. I picked a doctor younger than me, you know. And I told him the last time I had my appointment, I said, don't be retiring early. I said, you got to work at least until I'm done, you know. But I feel that way about Michael. I'm glad that he's a part of who we are. Let's have a prayer this morning and welcome the Lord's presence among us. And Mike, would you just come and stand here and just pray a prayer over us and over Michael today? I figure Mike praying over Mike is good.
And I'll use the mic. Yeah. Let's bow our heads. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for this chance for wonderful leaders across the Virginia district to come together and to hear Mike speak to us today about relevant and pressing issues that are happening in our world and right here in our church world. So Lord, I just pray that today each pastor and leader at the churches will take with them things back that will help the ministry that you've called each to do. And so Lord, just be with Mike. Guide us through this day. May we maximize our time together and for the fellowship as well. We thank you, Lord. In your name we pray. Amen.
Michael, you can go to around 10:30 and we'll pray whenever you're ready.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a joy to be with you this morning. Makes me wonder what kind of hardy folks you are that you're willing to get up at such an hour and come and spend a morning listening to a lawyer. It either tells me that you're a glutton for punishment or there's just nothing else going on around here. You need to come and see the freak show, the ordained attorney. But it is a pleasure being with you. Let me give you just a little bit of background about me. I was born and raised on a dairy farm in Michigan. It was when I was 8 years old, milking cows, that the Lord clearly told me that I needed to go to law school.
Hallelujah.
I used to have dreams, as my dad would wake me up at 4:30 every morning, of the day when I would be done and I could sleep in until some decent hour. I'm up at 4 o'clock every day. You can take the boy out of the farm, but you can't take the farm out of the boy. I was not raised in the Church of the Nazarene. I was raised Presbyterian, but I was predestined to be a Nazarene. It was not until I was a sophomore in college, though, that I ever set foot in the Church of the Nazarene. I was working as editor of our student newspaper. I was in the office, the building where my office was. There was a secretary who knew I wasn't going to church. And she said, you need to go to church, and you need to go to my church. She said, my husband teaches a Sunday school class for college-age students, and you need to go. And she was a pest. She would not take no for an answer. Every single week, she kept harping on me. So I finally said, yes, I will go. I thought, I'll go once, so she'll leave me alone. First time I walked through the doors of a Holiness church, and I heard the gospel. And I was raised in the church, but I'd never heard the gospel. Maybe it's just because I was too thick-headed. Amen. I don't know. But it was about 3 weeks later that I was saved.
Praise God.
And I am so grateful for that. Mm-hmm. I went on to law school, and after law school came right back to that community, Eureka, Illinois, where I was saved, and I was a prosecutor. And that's what I had wanted to be since I was 8 years old, and I loved it. I'm wired to be a prosecutor, and you'll probably hear me say this more than once, but I'm, to this day, I just generally assume everybody is guilty. If you give me enough time, I will find the evidence to. And so I was happily serving as a prosecutor, met my wife, we got engaged. It was March 21st, 1999. We were 3 months away from getting married. We're sitting in a Sunday night mission service, minding our own business, bothering nobody. When the Lord clearly said, if you ever want to be fulfilled in anything you ever do, again, you're going to come work for me. I was floored. This came out of the blue. I still wake up every day expecting to hear that there was an embarrassing mistake in the calling department. I was supposed to be putting the bad guys away. When the service was over, instead of getting up and talking with everybody as we usually did, Jody and I just sat there. And I looked at her and I said, what are you thinking? And she said, you go first. And I said, I think the Lord is calling me into ministry. And she said, I know. Well, he was calling you. He was speaking to me.
Amen.
So that began an exciting journey. It was a call into missions. So I left the state's attorney's office in Woodford County, Illinois, moved to Kansas City to go to seminary. Started off working in the planned giving department, and for a while was one of those guys who went around talking to churches about the importance of having a will and a state plan and so forth. Helped get the Church of the Nazarene Foundation started. And then when I was ordained, put in my application for missionary service. We went through missionary assessment, and then the day came where my wife and I were called to meet with Dr. Bussell, Director of World Mission. And right before we walked in, I turned to Jody and I said, what if he asked us to stay here in Kansas City? And she said, God would not do that to us. I said, well, just pray about it. So we walked in, and Louis was very gracious. He said, we've reviewed your assessment, and we affirm you are called and qualified to missions, and you have a place in missions. What would you say if for a season your mission field was in the office next to mine? He said, we desperately need someone who thinks like a lawyer to help us with some of the things we're dealing with around the world. And I, as I told Brother Carey this morning, had I known back on March 21st, 1999, that the Lord was calling me to Kansas City, I would have said no. I loved being a prosecutor. I found it incredibly fulfilling. But had I been responsible for choosing where I would have gone, it would have been so insignificant compared to what the Lord has given me over these years. The opportunity to see the church from so many different perspectives, it has been priceless. And then it was about 8 years ago, I guess, the church was involved in a very significant lawsuit. Up until that point, we had outsourced all of our legal work to outside firms. And as a result of that case, the powers that be said, you know, maybe we ought to have somebody in-house. And that corresponded with the time that Dr. Bussell was approaching retirement, so I transitioned over and became the first general counsel for the church. And that has been a fascinating journey. What I'm going to be sharing with you this morning is potentially frightening, potentially a bit overwhelming. I don't really want it to be either of those. I want it to be more of an invitation. I want you to know right up front that that you can always feel free to reach out to me. In fact, right now, let me give you the way to contact me. My email address is mthompson, M-T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, mthompson@nazarene.org. And my office number is 913-577-0612. 913-577-0612. I will tell you right now my disclaimer so that when you call me, we can save some time and you can tell me you've already heard the disclaimer. Yeah. I'm not licensed to practice law in Virginia. Therefore, I cannot be your attorney. And what I tell you does not take the place of qualified legal counsel with somebody of this state. What I can do is I can tell you some general principles about federal law. I can certainly tell you about the manual. I can tell you about precedent of things that other churches have done in similar situations. And if you do have to get an attorney, I'm always happy to talk to that attorney. We can speak legalese to one another without the need of an interpreter. It'll save time. It'll also save you money, because I can bring your attorney up to speed on this thing a lot faster than when he or she has to read through 404 pages. So, but I am always happy to talk to you. I will rarely be happy to talk to you about the things that you're calling me about, but I will always be happy to help you in any way that I can. The other disclaimers that I have for you are this. I'm going to have some illustrations that I'll be sharing with you today, either as part of my prepared material or in answer to questions that you might have. If anything that I share seems familiar, let me tell you now, it's not the church you're thinking of. It's another one. There are a lot of situations that come up. Rarely do they come just one time. So if it sounds like it's something that you've dealt with, it isn't. It's another church. So let's get that out of the way. Finally, this book here, my district superintendent tells me that when he walks into a board meeting, he knows right up front how difficult the board meeting is going to be on the basis of how many manuals are out. Let me tell you, this is your best friend. John Wesley said, "Lord, make me a man of one book, and I pray you will be twice the men and women that John Wesley was. You would be men and women of two books, the Word of God and the manual of the Church of the Nazarene." Now, I will be the first to admit, this is not the most artfully written thing. If you try to listen to the audio version of it when you're driving, you are a hazard to everybody on the road. There are things here that do not make sense. There are things here that are potentially contradictory. I get that. And we're trying to address that as we go. Hopefully, the General Assembly will clarify it a bit in just a few weeks. But I'll tell you that of all the situations that I've dealt with, and churches and pastors who have gotten into legal trouble, those who have stayed within the provisions of the manual have basically come through unscathed. When you deviate from it, then all the protections that this thing offers you, they go away. So stay within the provisions of the manual. All right. My best friend, my running buddy, is my dog, Skye. She runs with me every single morning, and she loves people most of the time. Occasionally, when we are running, though, I'll see somebody, and as we approach, instead of her tail wagging, the hair raises on her neck, and she'll start growling. And so that gets my attention, and I will look at the person she's growling at, and I think, well, I don't blame her. I would growl, too. That person's a dirtbag. It's obvious. This person is obviously up to no good, and you can spot them. You just simply can. So let me ask you, if I told you right now that you have somebody within your church, somebody who's attending today, who is going to be causing problems for you legally, do you think you could picture that person? Now, please don't mention any names. Think you got a person in mind? Let me narrow it down. If I told you that you're going to have $100,000 stolen from your church over some period of time, who do you think in your church is most likely to do it? Well, part of what we do in criminal justice is profiling. Let me tell you the profile of the person who is most likely to steal $100,000 from a local Church of the Nazarene. She is 42 years old, has worked for that church in a bookkeeping or finance capacity for at least 5 years. And their pastor says about her, "I would trust her with anything." That is, in Nazarene Most Wanted, that's your profile of the person who steals $100,000 from a local church. Now let's raise it some. For the person who's going to steal $200,000, everything that I said is the same, except it becomes a man. A man, 42 years old, who handles finance, who's been in that role for 5 years at least, and of whom the pastor says I would trust him with anything. Is that surprising at all? Why does that happen? Well, it happens because the person who probably came to your mind as being the most unsavory, the one who was most likely to steal money, you would never have allowed that person to be in that role in the first place. Mm-hmm. You put people whom you trust into positions of trust. So, obviously, you need to take from this that you need to go back and fire everybody who's within that. How does that happen? A recurring theme that we'll find with almost every single legal issue that we'll address today, a recurring theme that we're going to find with these legal issues is that when there is an absence of accountability, an absence of boundaries, an absence of transparency, where there is reckless trust, the devil gets an opportunity. I shared with the group yesterday a story that really impressed me back when our general superintendent, Gustavo Crocker, was regional director for Eurasia. I heard him dealing with a missionary. He was trying to put some protocols in place to address financial accountability. And he was getting pushback from the missionary, and the missionary said, "What's the problem? You don't trust me?" And Dr. Crocker said, "That's not true. I do trust you. It's the devil I don't trust." Mm-hmm. What we're going to find with these situations is that it's not a matter of not trusting people. We need to recognize that the devil is untrustworthy. And when we put people out there alone, it breeds temptation. It just creates all kinds of problems. So how do we deal with our serial thief? I mean, how do these things occur? One of the first situations that I dealt with from financial fraud was the church that pastor showed up at district assembly, looked at the reports of all the giving, and it said that their church had given nothing towards the World Evangelism Fund. I said, "Well, that's obviously a mistake. We paid over 100%. District secretary looked, checked with the district treasurer. No, we haven't gotten anything. So the pastor went back, checked the records, and saw check after check written. What's the problem? Well, the checks were written to general treasurer, Church of the Nazarene. But if you tracked it down and you saw where they were cashed at a local bank. The local church treasurer had gone to a local bank, set up a bank account in the name, general treasurer, Church of the Nazarene. Mm. She was the signatory. She was writing out the World Evangelism Fund checks, depositing them in what was essentially her own bank account. And it was an entire year, more than a year, before anybody found out about it. You will hardly ever find a situation of financial fraud where a person just wakes up one day and says, "Today is going to be the day that I throw away everything that I stood for. Today is the day that I'm just going to go whole hog out and fully embezzle every single dollar I can get my hands on." When I hear about a case where there has been any kind of embezzlement, I tell the pastor, and the pastor always says, "You know, I'm shocked. Didn't see this coming. I would have trusted her with anything." But I tell him, "Get ready, because you're going to find out a lot of stuff that you're not going to want to know about. You're probably going to find out that there is either an addiction, or there's gambling, or there's an affair going on. These things don't just happen overnight. There were some warning signs, but they were missed because we had somebody who was out there all by themselves with no one looking over them. So when you're looking at your church's financial policies, do you have anybody who is at risk by being put out there completely alone? You have problems if you have any situation where the same person who collects the offering, counts the offering, deposits the offering. You have a problem if the person who opens the mail also deposits the checks. You have a problem if the person who writes the checks writes a check to himself or herself. Doesn't mean that those things are themselves illegal. It means that those are situations where the devil has an opportunity. So how do we address that? You get at least one more set of eyes in every situation. As long as there is more than one set of eyes on the counting of money, the writing of checks, the depositing of checks, it's very hard for the devil to get in there. So avoid those situations where somebody is isolated. All right. Suppose I told you you've got another person in your church. This person is planning right at this very moment how to molest one of the children in your church. Do you have a picture of what that person looks like? we have an image, especially for those of my generation, I guess. Do you remember those commercials that they used to have, the Stranger Danger commercials, where they show the creepy guy in the trench coat who comes up and says, "Here, little boy, here, little girl, do you want the lollipop?" And the kids are told to yell, "Stranger Danger!" And they go running off. Is that your picture of the person who is going to molest our children? The typical person who will molest the children in our church doesn't look anything like that. Because if they did, you wouldn't let them anywhere near the children. People who are going to molest our children, they first have to present themselves as being helpful, trustworthy, and kind. They have to convince the parents or the guardians that they are safe people. They have to be likable to kids, because kids aren't going to go in towards anybody who's creepy and in a trench coat. They are going to be somebody who has been around, who is well-trusted, and who has access to just about any area of the church. So, what do we do about that? One of the most important responsibilities that I have is giving oversight to our child protection system. We call it Nazarene Safe. If you take nothing else away from here today, I hope that you will go back to your church and make sure it is a Nazarene Safe church. What is Nazarene Safe? You can go to NazareneSafe.org, and it is free. And it has resources there such as sample policies for local churches, for camps, for schools. You can download those. You can modify them for your own situation. There are videos on there that are free. Those videos are a longer, more in-depth, and better explanation of what I'm giving you right now. They are not themselves training on sexual abuse awareness. The Nazarene Safe videos are designed for ministry leaders to tell you why it's important for you to go back and implement a system of sexual abuse awareness training in your local church. Now, what's the difference? For most of the church's history, our approach to child protection has been, well, we're going to do background checks on our Sunday school teachers, and we'll have a policy. We'll have a two-adult rule. And basically, it's up to the pastor or the children's pastor to make sure that everything is safe. What we're trying to do now through Nazarene Safe is to change all of that. First of all, we still have to do background checks, no question about it. We still have to have good policies. And of course, it's going to be ultimately the pastor's responsibility to make sure that the policies are being implemented. But now what we're trying to do is equip as many people as possible, whether they're Sunday school teachers, whether they're helping out in the nursery, whether they're just the person who shows up once a year for VBS to hand out lemonade. We're trying to equip as many people as possible so that they understand what the grooming techniques are of the predators who are going after our children. So that if I see anything that looks the least bit suspicious, instead of me saying, "Boy, the pastor really ought to do something about that," or instead of me saying, "Pastor, I saw such and such, you need to do something about it." Instead, what happens is when I see something suspicious, I say, "That's wrong. I'm going to get up, and I'm going to go and make sure that that child is safe." Now, what do we mean by grooming techniques? What do these people do? The first thing I need you to understand is that they don't think like you do. That's the biggest mistake that we so often make. We will try to put our way of thinking into what we are seeing. But if that pedophile thought our way, they wouldn't be doing that sort of thing. And even if you try, you are not going to be able to rationally make sense of what is going on in a pedophile's mind. Why would a grown man be sexually aroused by an 8-year-old boy? I can't get there. I can't. But I can tell you what they do. Now, this is very instructive, because the first thing that they are going to do is they are going to look for any soft spots, any weak areas. That's why they've been coming to the churches. For a long time, they were going to schools. Schools got smart. They got policies in place. They're coming now to churches. Why? Because it's an atmosphere where, one, we're usually very eager to have new people come in. Two, we're usually desperate for people who are willing to help. Three, we love folks who are helpful, trustworthy, and kind, and who love to be around kids. And we're just trusting folks, aren't we? So they look for the soft spots, the weak spots, and they will come. And then when they get here, they're looking for easy prey. They're looking for the children who are on the margins, those who tend to be isolated, who don't get along with others, who come from difficult family backgrounds. They're looking for those who don't have good relationships already. Then they're going to side up to them. They're going to side up to the gatekeeper to those children, whether it be the parents or the guardians, present themselves as being helpful, trustworthy, and kind, and earn the trust. Now, if you're up until this point, what I've described is hopefully all of us. Because that's what we do in ministry, isn't it? We look for those who are marginalized. We look for those who are isolated. We look for those who are at risk. And we earn their trust. And we want to come alongside them and help them. So up till that point, the approach is the same. Here's where it differs. Because for those of us in ministry, the reason we're identifying those people is so that we can then bring them into community and help them experience wholeness in Christ. But for the pedophile, their grooming technique is to then take them and isolate them further. And the way that they will isolate them further is they start to capitalize upon any areas of shame that are already in that child's life. You will find that they zero in on anybody who already has any kind of history of abusing alcohol, drugs, or tobacco, anyone who has a history of pornography, anyone who has already been abused, and they will try to build shame into that. The pedophile will find ways of isolating that child and start introducing nudity and conversations of sexuality. They will start introducing pornography. They're going to be encouraging secrecy. And there will be greater and greater isolation as it goes on. When I get these calls, when something has happened, I have never had a pastor tell me, boy, we saw this one coming. It's never happened. They always say, I'm floored. Never saw this coming. I trusted this person completely. Everybody trusted him. This is Uncle Bob. Everybody loves Uncle Bob. Children love Uncle Bob. And they almost always will say, these accusations have to be false. Because nobody could possibly see that Uncle Bob would do something like this. But then you start asking questions. And when I start asking about things about these grooming techniques that I've just described, and I say, now, is there any history of, you know, getting children alone, having unsupervised contact with them, any concerns about nudity and so forth, invariably, I hear these five words, now that you mention it. And we'll hear about the nude basketball games. We'll hear about the nude Bible studies in the hot tub. We'll hear about the games of capture the flag at night, naked. I'm seeing the reaction in some of your eyes. You're saying, what? What? That's why when that stuff happened in those churches, no one did anything. Because you hear that and you think, what? That's stupid. What's he thinking? That's not right. Well, it's not right. But we're trying to apply a rational mindset to something there. And what we need to recognize is that what was going on in each of those cases, and all of those are true stories, by the way, what was going on in each of those cases was a gradual progression of intentionally checking to see which child was going to be most susceptible to being further isolated and subjected to these grooming techniques so that the abuse could occur. So how do we deal with that? NazareneSafe.org is free. What I really hope, what I really pray, what I really urge, beg, and plead is that every one of you go back and make it your mission that within the next 60 days, you would be a Nazarene Safe church. And to do that, you go to ministrysafe.com. Ministrysafe.com is our partner. They are the ones that helped us develop the Nazarene Safe material. Through Ministry Safe, you can get the training for everybody in your church on sexual abuse awareness. You can have them trained on the grooming techniques of pedophiles. There is a cost to this one. Ministry Safe, it is not the Church of the Nazarene, but we trust them. It's $200 per year per church. And it's $5 per person who successfully completes the online training. Training takes about 45 minutes. You can do it at your leisure. At the end of it, you get a certificate, good for 2 years, showing that you have been certified in this area. When that happens, then you've got people within your church who will recognize those issues and are going to be able to put an end to it. You need to adopt a policy of zero tolerance towards anything that is going to put any child at risk. That means that within your youth group, there's a no nudity policy. Now, that may seem obvious to some of us. Now, I have three teenage boys, but they're like me, so they're not really teenagers. And I was never really a teenager. So I don't really, that's the most terrifying part of ministry to me, by the way, is teens. Because I just don't get it. But I understand that it's not normal. And so there's some horsing around and stuff that happens. And in the course of that horsing around, I mean, it's going to be different than in senior adults. And sometimes we will look at stuff and say, well, that's just kids. But if you adopt that very clear, no nudity policy, that policy was adopted at a camp recently. And one of the camp directors, after being clearly told, nobody sees your butt, and he had to say it that plainly, he took the first opportunity to drop his pants and moon some kids. Well, the camp director, as soon as he saw that, called him in, said, that's it, you're out of here. Now, the excuse was, we were just horsing around. And people came to his defense and said, he's not a pedophile, he's just stupid. And the director said, either way, do we want him in charge of our kids? And that truly has to be our approach. I'm not saying that everybody's a pedophile. Those kids are the most precious thing we will ever be entrusted with. Why would we entrust them with somebody who's stupid? So we've got to do this. Let me tell you why this is so important to me. As I told you, I was a prosecutor. And as a prosecutor, I've handled every kind of case, from barking dogs to first-degree murder. I've had death penalty cases. And I've seen some horrible, horrible things. I've seen the worst that humanity can possibly do to each other. And blessedly, the Lord has cleared most of that stuff from my memory. Most of my memories of being a prosecutor are of the funny stories, the goofy people. And I'd love to share some of those stories with you. But there's one exception. I can still see very clearly in my mind every single child. Every single child victim. The ones who lived and the ones who died. And I wondered for the longest time, Lord, you've spared me from the others. Can't you spare me of these too? But I'm grateful now that he hasn't, because I believe that the opportunity will come where I'm going to meet those victims. And I'm prepared for the day when they ask me, what did you do with the experience that you gained from my case? With what you learned in handling my case, what did you do to make sure there would be nobody else who would have to suffer my fate? And I will not look them in the eyes and tell them that I did nothing. There's nothing more important that we will ever do than to watch out for the least of these. So I plead with you to go and make sure that your church is safe for our children. Now, usually in a setting like this, I will ask pastors and church leaders, how many of you right now know what your policy is as it relates to child protection? Generally, I will get maybe about half of the hands come up. So then I'll say, okay, of those of you who have your hands up, how many of you could put your hands on that written policy right now? And about half the hands fall. And then I say, for those who still have your hand up, if you were to give me that policy now, and I were to be looking at that as I watch the activities of your church, how many of you would say that we would have to take that policy over to the library and file it in the fiction section rather than the nonfiction section? You see, what we have done, what our practice has been for the longest time, is that we will adopt a policy because somebody says we need to have a policy. A board meeting will come along and somebody says, you know, the insurance company says we have to have a child protection policy. So they put one on the table, vote on it, it gets filed away, no one pays attention to it again. Most churches that have a child protection policy have a two-adult rule. It says it can't have, if you've got children in a room, there must be two adults there. How often is that violated? As a general rule, you are better off having no policy than to have a policy you don't follow. Because when you have a policy that you don't follow, you have just given the plaintiff's attorney who is going to be suing you, you've given them all the ammunition that they need to come after you. Because you are ipso facto in violation of policy. Your board has just said this is very important, this cannot be violated, and you've violated it. Now, I'm not saying you should go and get rid of your policies. I do say that you need to take a look at your policies and your practices and decide what has to change. In some cases, your practices will need to change. In some cases, your practices are fine, but your policies that need to be modified to come into conformity with your practices. In my local church, we have an education wing. We had a two-adult rule, but it was not practical under our circumstances to have two adults in every one of those classrooms. But what we were able to do is, in that main hallway of the education wing, basically take out those walls and put in big glass windows so that it was possible for somebody standing in the hallway to be able to look into all of those classrooms at one time. So there was at least one teacher in each classroom, and there was at least one person out of the hallway at all time. It was not possible for there to be just one set of eyes on any situation. It was not possible for anyone to be isolated, alone, for the devil to have an opportunity. That works. As Pastor Carey told you, I'm not only am I a lawyer, I'm an elder. And I also serve as an interim pastor for extended periods. Before I started pastoring, I'll tell you, my philosophy was I would get calls all the time. Pastors, district superintendents, they'd tell me about something, and I'd say, it's in the manual. Just read the manual. If you would just read the manual. I had to repent of that when I started pastoring. In fact, I sent a text to my district superintendent one day, and it said, God's instructions on how to live a holy, honorable life are contained in 10 Commandments. Constitution of the United States with instructions on how to govern a nation of over 300 million people fits nicely on 9 typed pages. But I just read through 404 pages and I still don't know how to fill a vacancy on the NMI Council. So I get it. I get that the nuances of ministry deal with real life and it doesn't always fit neatly within these paragraphs. I understand. And I don't want you to feel that you're out there all by yourself trying to figure this out. So if you're running into a situation, I do hope that you will call me and see if we can't work this out. When you call me about an issue of sexual misconduct, well, first of all, I need you to know something else. Every state has different laws as it concerns who is a mandatory reporter for child abuse. In the Church of the Nazarene, we've made it really, really easy. You are a mandatory reporter for child abuse. Every pastor, every staff member, every Sunday school teacher, every VBS volunteer, custodian, if you have any kind of responsibility within the Church of the Nazarene, you are a mandatory reporter, which means you must immediately report any reasonable suspicion that a child has been or will be harmed. That's a reasonable suspicion. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. It does not obligate you to or empower you to go and investigate. It does not mean that you call together a whole bunch of people to weigh the pros and cons and see who thinks he's guilty and who doesn't. It means you report it, and you report it in a timely manner. The highest area of liability within the Church of the Nazarene relates to sexual misconduct against minors. For many years, it was because of incidents that were occurring within our churches or at church activities or by church personnel. Thankfully, to God be the glory, those cases are on rapid decline because we are educating our people and because you are making sure that our churches are truly safe. However, it still remains the highest area of liability, but it relates to failure to report in a timely manner. And the big cases that are out there right now are incidents that did not occur on church property. Church people had nothing to do with it. But somebody within the church found out, heard a reasonable suspicion that the child had been abused and did not report it in a timely manner. There was a case not within the Church of the Nazarene, but a large church in Texas, not too long ago, where a girl said something in a Sunday school class to her teacher about having been molested. The teacher said something to the youth pastor. Youth pastor said something to the senior pastor. They got the leadership team together. They discussed it, and they reported it. They hotlined it 5 days later. And then pastor, youth pastor, Sunday school teacher, Sunday school superintendent, whole bunch of them. Their mugshots were on the front page of the newspaper the next day when they were indicted for failure to report in a timely manner. You can't sit on this. You can't wait on it. It's something that you report right away. Now, what's going through most of our minds when we hear that is, but what if it's wrong? What if it's wrong? It might be. That's not your burden. Your burden is to report it to those who will investigate it. I had a situation not too long ago where I was speaking to a group like this. And at the end of it, one of the pastors came up to me and said, "Are you the lawyer who was involved in such and such a case?" And he said the name of a case that I was involved in, where there was a girl who had claimed that somebody had been abusing her. And it had not gotten reported. It hadn't been dealt with. And I got a hold of it, and I pursued it. And ultimately, it was proven to be true. Well, I didn't know where he was going on this one. I thought it was probably the brother-in-law of the fellow who lost his credentials. But I said, "Yeah, that was me." And he said, "My daughter was the one who was saved because you believed her." He said, "She was just asking the other day, do you think the opportunity would ever come for me to meet that lawyer who believed me? Would you be willing to meet with my family?" I said, "I would be honored." Because I usually stand over the train wreck and count the victims. I rarely get to see survivors. And I got to meet this beautiful young lady who, by the grace of God, is finding healing. And she said, "You were the first one who believed me." Now, people have been wrongfully accused. Let me tell you, if you have a true Nazarene-safe church, you're not going to have to worry about that. Because if you have a policy in place where there's no opportunity for people to be isolated, to go off alone, there's always going to be witnesses. But again, let me just tell you, it's your responsibility to report, not to investigate. And don't drop the ball on that one. So, should you ever call me about this, on anything related to sexual misconduct against minors, the first thing I will say to you is, has it been hotlined? And if it hasn't, the moment you hang up this phone, you hotline it. And then you need to confirm with me that you have hotlined it, or else I hotline it. Then I'll say to you, have you talked to your district superintendent? Don't ever let your district superintendent be blindsided. The manual is your best friend. Your DS is your second best friend. Whether it's on a matter of sexual misconduct or whether it's related to whether you can use unfermented wine in communion, whatever it is, your DS is there for a reason. He's an excellent resource. Don't ever let your DS be blindsided. Call upon him at every opportunity. I don't think he would hang up on you. Would you, Dr. Ford?
703-384-8672-4-804-59-NAS-DS.
As I said, I'm supposed to be the expert on this thing. Jared Rowell is my DS. He's on speed dial. We talk all the time. Don't try to do it alone. Keep your DS in the loop. Then the third thing I'll say to you is, have you notified your insurance company yet? Your insurance policies probably have a provision that say that you must immediately notify your insurance carrier of the possibility of a claim. Doesn't mean that there will be a claim. You need to notify them when there's a possibility of a claim. If you don't notify them in a timely manner, they have the right to deny coverage. So if you find out that there's a possibility and you wait for a month or so, and then there is a claim, one of the first things insurance will do is say, when did you find out about this? Why didn't you call us? And so sorry, too late. And while we're on that topic, as it relates to insurance, there's only three for sure, possibly four companies that actually cover churches for sexual misconduct against minors. Philadelphia, Church Mutual, Brotherhood Mutual. Other church policies, you really want to take a look at it. You may have something on there like an umbrella coverage for $5 million or so, and it might have a provision in there saying sexual misconduct, but when you read the fine print, there will be exclusions. And it will say something like, you've got $5 million umbrella liability coverage, but for sexual misconduct, you have $15,000 coverage. Or, and this is one I saw not too long ago, sexual misconduct coverage, full coverage for employees who have committed misconduct while acting in conformity with your policy. So first of all, you don't be an employee. If it's not an employee who has committed the offense against the child, you got no coverage. Second of all, I really hope none of your policies permit any employee to commit sexual misconduct against a minor. They are, by default, in violation of your policy, which means you have no coverage. And I've had too many painful conversations with pastors who call me, and I say, hotline it, call your DS, call your insurance company. And they'll call me an hour later and say, we just found out we don't have coverage. That's ghastly. It will shut that church down, and then they go after the district. So please, make sure you've got that coverage in place. Boy, isn't that an uplifting thing? About three times a week, I get a phone call along these lines. It starts off this way. We have somebody who is attending our church, and he is creepy. He is weird. He makes people uncomfortable. And the first time I got that call, I said, I'm glad Uncle Harold found a church. They say, we've discovered this person is a sex offender, and we need some guidance. That's how the call always starts. Then it almost always goes one of two ways. First one is, we need to know how we can excommunicate this person, bar them, prevent their shadow from ever being cast upon church property ever again. Or, they will say, we are a church of grace, and we have made this person our children's director.
No.
And we want you to bless it. I'm not kidding. It's very rarely somewhere in between. It's those two extremes. So let's address that. One resource I want to point you to is the Nazarene Document Library. If you forget the address, which I often do, I just Google Nazarene Document Library and it'll take you there. But the web address is nazarene.org/document library. No spaces. And there's a little tab, a little section there called Legal Forms and Policies or something. It's got legal in its name. That's my area. Please take a look at that. There's stuff that I've written up there that as soon as I start getting multiple questions on an issue from a church, I'll usually write something up in answer to it and put it there. But one of the resources there in that legal section is a covenant for a sex offender. It is something that you are free to download and modify and make it your own. It is basically an agreement that you would reach with a sex offender, and it spells out the boundaries that would be in place for that person to be within your church. Now, you need to understand that unless the judge has specifically addressed the issue of his attending your church, sex offenders are free to attend church. The covenant will, as I started off saying that we get in trouble when people go off without accountability, without transparency, this sets the boundaries and accountability in place. You reach an agreement with this person in advance saying, when you're here at the church, it's going to be with these people. And you'll be with these people all the time. You're not going to be around children. You're not even going to go to the bathroom by yourself. It has all this stuff. Now, if the person is not a member, you are free to exclude a non-member from your church at any time. I'm a member of the Church of the Nazarene, but I'm not a member of your local church. So if you don't like me, at any time, you can say, Mike, be gone. And if you come back, we're calling the police. It's that easy when it comes to a non-member. But if it's a member of your church, you may not restrict their rights and privileges without going through the disciplinary process set forth within the manual. Manual, section 600, deals with discipline of a layperson. What that covenant agreement does is it has a provision right at the end that says, I agree that if I'm in violation of the terms of this covenant, I give up my rights to be here at this church. That the pastor can exclude me. And what you do there, you avoid the difficulty of having to go through a contested disciplinary process for a layperson, which hardly ever goes well, and you can take that action. Now, the sex offender will probably push back at first and say, why should I do this? You don't trust me. The response is, I do trust you. It's the devil I don't trust. The sex offender will usually recognize that he is, that people are looking for an opportunity for him to screw up, that they distrust him, that they fear him. This covenant will protect him just as much as it protects the children and the church. Because if he follows the provisions of that covenant and there is an accusation made against him, he's going to know that he's safe. Because there would have been a witness around at all times to be able to say, I was there, and nothing happened. So it will be for his protection, and I hope that you will be able to make use of that. That's an answer to the question of those who want to just excommunicate the person. Now, that is a decision for a local church. If the local church chose to adopt the philosophy that if you're a sex offender, you can't be here, that is your call. I wouldn't advise it, but you're free to do that. But in this other area where we believe in grace, and so we made him our youth director, our children's pastor, you need to hear me on this. And I am making sure I remember everyone who is here today, so that you cannot tell me you've never heard this before. I've got it. The manual and rulings of the Board of General Superintendents are crystal clear, and there's no wiggle room in this one. Anyone who has a history of sexual misconduct with a minor may never be in any position whatsoever in the local church. They can't be a board member, children's pastor, sound person, worship leader, groundskeeper. They may be a parishioner only with no other responsibilities within the local church. Now, that may be somewhat offensive to some of you. When I wear my pastor's hat, I push back at it a little bit. Because does that mean that we don't believe in grace? Are we saying that sex offenders are beyond the reach of the cross, that they can never be transformed? Well, no, it's not saying that. What it is saying is that there are consequences to certain things, that the cross covers all sin. There are still consequences in this world. In a setting like this, I will generally get somebody who will want to argue with me about whether that is good policy or not. Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence. I can tell you that your breath is wasted on me because even if I agree, I can't do a blessed thing about it. This is the manual. The General Assembly and the General Assembly alone can change this. It's manual paragraphs 538.9 and 903.3 deal with this issue. The Board of General Superintendents have clarified it and expounded upon it with their rulings. Only the General Assembly can change it, which means it is the law of the land. So what's the big deal? Because almost always in a setting like this, there will be at least three churches where somebody will say, yeah, we got a problem. And the problem is with Uncle Bob. Uncle Bob, he's a sex offender, but it happened a long time ago, and he is radically transformed. No question about it. I trust him completely. We've even put protections in place to make sure he doesn't have contact with children. We've got him teaching adult Sunday school. We've got him on the board. We've got him working in the sound booth, whatever it is. That what you've said might work for everybody else, but you don't understand my church, and you don't know Uncle Bob. I get it. Let me tell you where the problem comes in, and I guarantee you this is where the problem will come in. Let's say that you allow Uncle Bob to continue to be in that position within your church, and you are absolutely right about him. You never have a problem with them. However, despite your best efforts, somebody else hurts a child. It took you by surprise, as it always will, but there was a child who was hurt in your church. And now you are being sued. You're going to find yourself sitting in the witness stand, and somebody like me, with the attack eyebrows,
I noticed that.
He's going to start questioning you. And the questioning will be something like this. Pastor, I call your attention to Plaintiff's Exhibit A, the manual of the Church of the Nazarene. This is the supreme law of the denomination. Is that not correct?
Yes.
It's established by your General Assembly, the supreme legislative body of the church, correct?
Yes.
It is what you go by. It is agreed upon by 162 world areas, right?
Yes.
Calling your attention to manual paragraph 538.9. You familiar with this? Well, yeah, I remember a guy talking about it. Back one day in March of 2017. It clearly says that no one with a history of sexual misconduct with a minor may ever be in any position of leadership, trust, or authority within the Church of the Nazarene in the local church, correct?
Yes.
What about Uncle Bob? Well, let me see, Uncle Bob. This isn't about Uncle Bob. He had nothing to do with the reason why we're in court today. Beside the point. Pastor, the fact is, Manuel says that Uncle Bob couldn't be in that leadership position, right?
Yeah, but you don't know Uncle Bob.
I get it, Pastor. What you're telling me is that the manual is optional for you. You get to pick and choose. So if something's important enough for you, you can disregard what this says. Is that right? You're above the law if it's important enough to you? I guess children don't matter much to you. Fact is, it's pretty obvious children are second-class citizens in your church, aren't they? Only way that children are going to be important to you is if it costs you money, it sounds like. Because, Pastor, really, you're beneath contempt, aren't you? You're just about what works for you, and children don't matter.
I object.
I see that turn.
That's my turn. Now, what I've just said might even halfway convince some of us. But we're not the ones who will be sitting in judgment. It's going to be 12 people sitting over here in the jury box. 12 people who, by definition, will not be members of the Church of the Nazarene, probably will not attend church. And they're going to be sitting there looking at you, Pastor, saying, who do you think you are? Let me tell you the other way this might happen. Because, you see, as a pastor, it's very easy for me to say, I know my church better than anybody else. I know the risk, and if I'm wrong, I'll take it on the chin. Here's where it's going to come into play. Let's say that we have that same situation with Uncle Bob. And the pastor was right. Never have trouble with Uncle Bob. We never have trouble in that church. Praise the Lord. We got another church on the other side of the district. And despite the best efforts of that pastor and the board, a child is hurt. That church is sued. The district is sued. The denomination is sued. The district and the denomination will immediately file a motion for summary judgment because under our structure, the denomination and the district do not have authority over lay people. Discipline of a lay person rests with the local church, right? So they're going to have your district superintendent on the witness stand and attack eyebrows come and say, now, Dr. Fuller, calling your attention to People's Exhibit A. You're aware of the provision that says that no one can be in a position of leadership, trust, or authority? Yes, I'm aware of that. You're aware of Uncle Bob over here in this church. And he'll say, wait a minute. First of all, that church has nothing to do with it. And besides, Uncle Bob's a layperson. I couldn't remove Uncle Bob from that position if I wanted to. The manual doesn't permit that. The attorney will say, that's true. But you have the authority to take action against the pastor of that church for acting in violation of the manual, don't you? And you decided you'd turn the other way. It just wasn't a big enough deal. You were too busy. You had other things to worry about because it was a child. Hey, it's just a child. You don't care about children on this district, do you? What kind of a retrobate are you? You are just... What's it going to take to get the churches of this district to pay attention to the needs of children? And now, because of the actions of one pastor, all of us are at risk. We are a connected church. The manual is your best friend when you stay within it. But when you step outside of it, all of these problems come into play. So, it's very easy for me as a pastor to say, I know my church, I'm willing to take the risk. It's quite a different thing when I recognize that my decisions cost you. So please, it is a very, very important issue. I recently, about a year ago, a district superintendent asked me to come and meet with a church board. They had this issue going on. Uncle Bob was a board member. Pastor was brand new. I told him, you can't have him there on the board. They wouldn't listen. They wouldn't listen to the DS. DS said, you know, called me. He said, you intimidate the daylights out of me. Maybe you'll... So I went there and I met with the board. And I shared this story with them about why it's such a big deal. And blessedly, they agreed. And Uncle Bob resigned from the board. And last week, I got a call from the pastor because there has been an incident at that church. Unrelated to Uncle Bob. But a child's been hurt. Had Uncle Bob remained on that board, all of that that I had just prophesied would have come true. So, it is exceptionally important. All right. Let's move on to something a little lighter, huh? Let me just quickly hit on some of the top issues that come across my desk these days. And I want to have an opportunity for there to be questions also. So let me hit a couple of them, and we'll take a break. One area that's rapidly causing problems for churches is the area of copyright infringement. And it's coming from a number of ways, but the biggest way is as it relates to stuff that's on the Internet. Increasingly, we're doing things such as live streaming of services, whether it be through some professional thing or whether it's by Facebook Live, whatever it may be. They have, the copyright companies, the music industry, they hire people whose full-time job it is to simply surf the web, looking for churches who broadcast music over the Internet. You've got to be licensed to be able to do that. If it's a copyrighted work, if it's a work that has not yet passed into the public domain, then you have to have a license. CCLI will do that for you. There's other services that do it. But having just the regular CCLI license that allows us to put stuff up on PowerPoint and so forth does not cover webcast. You need to make sure that you've got that as well. And they're going after the most unlikely churches. They're not going after the mega churches. They're usually going after the smaller ones because they really want to make an example. You don't need that headache. So you got a couple options. You can either... make sure that you are properly licensed, or cut out the music part on your webcast. Just go with the sermon. That's the best part anyway, isn't it? So watch out in that regard. Also, copyright infringement, it is coming up quite a bit as it relates to stuff that's being put out on the web for printed material. Please make sure that if it's something that has already been published, that you have gotten permission to be able to post it. So you don't have troubles there. Marriage is a hot button, and that's in two different ways. Of course, we have the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage. Manual is very, very clear that in the Church of the Nazarene, we recognize marriage is a sacred institution created by God. It exists only in a relationship between one man and one woman. As elders and deacons, we may only solemnize marriage where there has been careful counseling, where there is a biblical basis for marriage, and that biblical basis exists only between one man and one woman. The law of the land says that, well, before we get into the law, let me tell you where the questions come up. I often will get a call from somebody who says, I have this couple that want to get married, but they want it to be a religious wedding, not a legal wedding. They want me to to solemnize it within the church, but not file anything at the courthouse. Can I do that? The answer is no, you may not. The law in every single state says that those who are authorized to solemnize marriage may only do it in accordance with the law, and the law says that you've got to make sure that there is a valid marriage license and that you do whatever the follow-up is required of in your state. Some states, you just have to sign the marriage license and it's up to the newlyweds to file it. In other states, it's up to the minister to file it at the courthouse. Whatever it is, you've got to follow through on it. In every single state, you can go to jail if you don't do that. Now, it used to come up in one of two ways. Usually it was an elderly couple that it was their second marriage for one or both of them. And one of them or both of them were getting some sort of survivor benefits, either some kind of a pension, or maybe they were getting alimony or whatever that would end if they got remarried. And so they wanted to get remarried, but they didn't want to lose the financial benefit. So they just didn't want that marriage license to be filed. Okay? That's fraud. I guess just flat out wrong. So shouldn't even have to entertain that one. But it's also illegal in terms of just doing a religious ceremony without filing it as well. We also sometimes see it as it relates to somebody who may have difficulty getting a marriage license. Perhaps it is somebody who doesn't have, because they're not in the country legally, there's concerns about whether they can get a marriage license or not. I don't know what the law is here in Virginia. Most states, there's a way to still legally get a marriage license. You'd want to look and see what the law is. Now, I have the advantage of, I live in Missouri, I work in Kansas. And in Kansas, one of the two states, you don't need to present a birth certificate in order to get a marriage license. And there was a couple that, one of them was from Mexico and was having difficulty getting his birth certificate in time. I told him, just go across the state line. Because in the other state, there's not even a requirement that you be a resident in order to get the marriage license. Go across the state line, get your marriage license, have the pastor meet you right over there, do a quick ceremony, come back into this state before all your friends and family, and renew your vows.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. It's perfectly legal. There are ways of getting it done. Don't take, if somebody says to you, I just can't get a marriage license, don't drop it at that. There's almost always legal ways that it can be done. We're also seeing it as it relates to the issue of same-sex marriage. There was a lot of fear that came up after the Supreme Court decision that legalized same-sex marriage. Let me address some things right now. The Supreme Court did not criminalize it for pastors to refuse to perform a wedding ceremony. They didn't address that issue at all. They did not make it illegal for a church to refuse to have a same-sex ceremony. They didn't address that issue at all. What they said was same-sex marriages have to be recognized by the civil authorities of the state. They didn't touch the issue of churches. Too many churches reacted in fear and said, well, we're just going to say no one can get married at this church unless they are members. Or our pastor is no longer authorized to perform weddings. First of all, you can't do that. The pastor has independent authority aside from what the board does. The board may say he or she can't do the weddings on these premises, which can't limit your pastor from doing his sacerdotal authority. And we have some churches that have said, well, our pastor will only do a religious ceremony after they have been married by the civil authorities. That's an overreaction, and it is a relinquishment of the spiritual authority that we've been given, because marriage belongs in the church. We shouldn't abdicate this. We need to accept the leadership in that area. Now, we do have to be wise about a few things, because there may be some issues as it relates to the use of the facilities. If we make our facilities available to the general public to have receptions or to have weddings or whatever, and then we say to one group, yes, you may use these facilities, and to this group, you can't, there is potentially a problem. So how do we deal with that? Another resource there in that Nazarene Document Library in the legal section is a facilities use policy, something like that. It has facilities in its name. That's a policy that you would be free to download and modify for your local church purposes. But what it says is basically everything that happens in our local church is our act of worship and our obedience to our religious responsibilities as we interpret the Holy Scriptures. That means that if something is proposed to happen in our church and it is inconsistent with our act of worship or our understanding of the Holy Scriptures, we say no to it. Why is that important? The courts will tell us that we're wrong if we simply make broad statements on social issues. If we say homosexuals cannot use our facilities, the courts will say, oh, yes, they can. But courts will not, to this date, tell us that we are wrong in how we interpret our holy books. Courts will not tell us that we are wrong in how we determine what our religious responsibilities are. So everything that we have framed within that sample policy is designed along those terms. And so if we adhere to that and we say no to something because it is inconsistent with what we understand is our religious obligations and our act of worship, courts will leave us alone on that. You do have to be cautious, though, because you have to follow that policy with regard to everything. Do you let the Boy Scouts come in and use your building? Do you let Weight Watchers come in and use the building? Do you let your building be used as a polling place on election day? How are those acts of worship or consistent with our religious obligations? Well, we have written within that policy some, I call it weasel words. It's wiggle room. But basically it says that the pastor has the authority to exercise his or her judgment as the Holy Spirit gives the pastor to determine what groups, what activities are necessary to meet the strategic purposes for that church within that community. You must then have a reasonable articulation of why you're allowing this activity to take place. What's a reasonable articulation? You've got to be able to explain it so that the ordinary person with ordinary intelligence, could understand it. So, a church that I was pastoring, they wanted to have the Girl Scouts come in and use the building. We had just, at that board meeting, passed this policy. And I said, well, what are we going to do? If the Girl Scouts are just going to come in and use a room one night a week, and then they're gone, and we have no other interaction with them, we cannot allow them to do it because it would be inconsistent with this policy. There's nothing there that says that this is part of our act of worship. There's nothing there that's consistent with our religious obligations. However, if we are going to be intentional about this church connecting with the lives of these girls, if we're going to be reaching out to them and to their families, if we're going to be finding ways of integrating them into our services and so forth, I, as pastor in good faith, can on a witness stand say, this is part of this church's strategy to reach to the areas where the church is not yet. Weight Watchers coming in, if they're just coming in because they pay us $25 a week, nope, can't do it. But if you've got a plan, a way of being able to use that in order to expand the church. Now, it's got to be legitimate. You can't hand out a flyer to everybody who comes in, and then that's the end of it. You got to have a legitimate way of that meeting your strategy for reaching the community. Having people come in and vote, having it be a polling place where you can't even have any kind of proselytizing taking place, how can that work? Well, you have to have a lot of interaction with the poll workers, with the election judges, with county and municipal officials. I could come up with a way that would reasonably articulate how that would fit within my strategy for expanding the church and fulfilling our mission, the reason God raised us up in this community. I can articulate that, and I can point to evidence of how we're trying to do that. But you got to take a look at that in every single place, because if you're not paying attention to it with regard to those activities, but then somebody comes along and they want to rent your facilities in order to have a wedding reception, and you say no because it's a same-sex couple, that sure looks like discrimination. It looks like you're picking and choosing when you're going to apply your policy. And for that matter, if you have a policy that says only those who profess to be in agreement with the beliefs of the Church of the Nazarene may use our facilities, okay? Do you ever let anybody use the facilities who they have not been faithful in their vows. You ever let people who don't tithe use your facilities? You ever let anybody who belongs to a secret society come into the facilities? If you're picking and choosing, then you've got Mr. Attack Eyebrows again. We'll go after you on the witness stand, saying, the fact of the matter is, you just hate gay people, don't you? That's all it's about. All this other stuff is just cloaking it. You'll let anybody else use your facilities? You hate gay people, don't you? So, be strategic in how you do this stuff. It is 10:30. Let's take a 10.
I don't know how else to respond. Applause seems a little weird, but let's clap. It's kind of like clapping after a sad movie. But I'm glad I'm here today.
Amen.
And that's why when I was in Missouri, I just felt that I can't know this myself. Other people have to know this. And I appreciate Brother Fuller agreeing wholeheartedly with this day. And I want to say something about Michael before he comes to the next session, and we'll have Brother Fuller address us right after the break, anything he'd like to share. But Michael, come to your church, and you can bring him in to talk to your board. He also does Faith Promise, so you could bring him in for a weekend of Faith Promise, have him meet with your board while you got him there. He's a great resource. And,
does he do Faith Promise with the Attack Eyebrows?
Yes.
He will.
I told Michael this won't be his first and last visit to Harrisonburg, I'm sure of that. But, you know, in his heart, when I asked him to come, he said, I'll pay my way to come if you'll let me come share this. And we didn't take him up on that, but he meant it. I could tell that it's his heart. I want to give you the CEU number for today. Because if I give it right after the break, 10 of you will still be talking to each other out here at the bagel stand. So last time I did give the wrong number, but I corrected it with everyone I knew to correct it with. If you didn't get the right number last time, see Bruce. I think he got it. It's on my phone, too, but for some reason I gave the wrong digit. But today it's 18832. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you're probably better off, so don't worry a lot about it. But if you go to learning, L-E-A-R-E-N-I-N-G, .nazarene.org, you now keep record of your own continued education units, and it is much easier. So what I have to do now before every teaching church is send a paragraph about what this day is about, and they give me a number. So when you go there and set up your account, you just put this number in, and it brings you right up. All you have to do is add the hours. So, if you happen to be with us yesterday for 3 hours, and today for 3 hours, you can get 6 hours. If you're here today, you get 3 hours. So, we'll try to keep that current. We have this system also in place for the district team retreat. So, it is a good way to keep up with, and I think a 20 minimum is kind of what the church shoots for. In the manual. Yes, question, Doug.
No question, just comment. I did it. It was very easy.
You did it. It was very easy. Thank you, Doug. I need good word, Brother Fuller.
I think what Doug's saying is if Doug can do it, anybody can do it.
And DS said if Doug can do it, anybody can do it. But I think he was quoting Doug. He was interpreting Doug. Yeah. He wasn't making a comment.
I just would like to say about that. Some people say, well, who really ever sees that?
Yeah.
And I would just say that district superintendents, when we look at a candidate's profile, especially for a pastoral position, you may or may not know that that comes up on the profile about the level of your engagement in.
So if you're looking for a new church, you really need to get you some. And some of you are wondering why you haven't got better opportunities on the district. Now you know. You haven't been studying. Okay.
See, it's nice to have the statement and then the shadow.
Yes. Well, I did want to make one comment on something that Michael said. The young lady that he met, who, you know, he had believed her, she told him that because of this, she's now going to study criminal justice.
Wow.
Because he made such an impact on her. And to think that if an attorney can do that, what can pastors do? He wanted me to say that. But when he's talking, I have this neat shadow of Wilberforce. You know, I don't know if you've seen the movie Amazing Grace, but it'd be worth watching. I would recommend that, according to manual discretion, that you would see Amazing Grace. But let's take about 8-10 minutes, whatever you need, and let's be back in so our BS can share with us a few things. And then Michael's going to cover the really deep stuff.
Oh, wow.